Accession number 19672, Reel 3.
This is Neil Tiddle, Reel 3.
And whilst we were in Lyon, we were held up by enemy fire, and we took shelter in some houses just off the beach. And I think we spent all day, if I remember rightly, waiting for communications to be established between ourselves and the ships at sea who'd been designated as our firepower, so that we could blast these people who were holding us up. But of course, radio communication was not as it is today. It was a little bit hit and miss, and we were without inter-unit communication for most of the first day anyway. So we were held up by these snipers and guns that the enemy were shooting at us with. We spent the night in Lyon somewhere, and the following day we went to Luxemer, which is a small village a little further up the coast, to help out another unit of ours, 48 Commando, who were having difficulty. That was settled. And from there we went to...
In what way was it settled?
Well, they were either killed or they were overcome. Whatever, I can't remember now what it was actually, but they were being held up and they needed assistance, and we went to their assistance and the problem was resolved, and we both were then detailed for another job a mile and a half inland. There was an underground radar station which had about 300 or 400 German troops in it, which had an open view of the beach, and they also had some guns that they could direct their fire onto the beach, and our job was to clear it. And we sat around it for a couple of days, I remember, observing it. It was surrounded, it was in a field, and it was surrounded as with mines. It was a minefield surrounding it, and we had to have flail tanks brought up to flail their way in to clear the mines before we could actually go in. So we sat round there for a couple of days, and eventually the tanks came and we followed them in. The Germans were all underground in concrete emplacements, and took a lot of convincing before they came out. We actually dropped grenades down their ventilation shafts, and the blokes who could speak German gave them verbal instructions and warnings about what would happen if they didn't come out. But eventually they all came out, and there were about 300 of them.
What was your own role in that attack?
Well, I was always communication, so I did very little actual combat. I was in combat, but not using weapons, although I had them to use if need be. My role was communications. I remember the officer in charge of this underground radar station gave the gave the impression that you get from looking at SS officers. He was, I don't know whether he was SS or not, but he was tall, he was arrogant, and he had a lovely leather raincoat, overcoat, which I liked. So I asked my sergeant major if I could have it, and he said, yeah, certainly. And he went over to this bloke and said, take it off, which he did. And the sergeant major gave it to me, and I used it for months as a ground sheet in my foxholes, various places. Lovely coat.
Talking about height, just going back to the landings, you were talking about the question of height and the depth of the water. How tall were you then?
I was about 5'10". 5'10½", something like that. It's up to my chest, you know. And these two lads were a lot shorter than me. And the sway and the swell and the forward movement, we got ashore. One of them got killed, incidentally.
How were these prisoners treated?
How were they treated?
Yes.
Very well. I never saw any... I never saw in all my service in the Marines where we actually had prisoners. I never ever saw any ill treatment of any German prisoners at all. Unfriendly, yeah. Especially if they were non-cooperative. But I never saw any ill treatment as we know it. They were treated as prisoners of war.
And after the capture of this bunker?
Pardon?
After the capture of this bunker?
Oh, yeah. A place was called La Deliverand, or Duver, D-O-U-V-R-E-S, Duver. From there, we went to help the airborne who'd taken Pegasus Bridge. And the Germans were quite strong still in the surrounding areas of Hermannville and La Deliverand, Salonelles and places around the bridge. So we went over there to help out to contain these people, stop them from pushing back into the beachhead. And we were there, I should imagine, from late June until August, I should imagine. Well, we were there until the breakout from Falais, when the Americans broke out and did that circular touch. We were on the coast, always on the coast. I would say around about August time, we moved from there and chased what we'd got in our area down to the Seine through various towns and what have you.
Did you have much contact with civilians in Normandy?
A little, yes. We used to go scrounging for eggs and whatever else we could get in the way of fresh food. You know, when I say scrounging, we paid for it with script, as we call it, the invasion money. There's no looting or stealing or anything like that. We paid our way.
What was the attitude of civilians towards you in Normandy?
Oh, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Well, you can imagine, can't they? They've had four and a half years of captivity, and they're now, for want of a better term, they're free. They're liberated. And they were delighted. In fact, from from the Seine, the other side of the Seine, all the way up to Belgium, where we had very little contact with the Germans, only small pockets of resistance which didn't last very long. For about a fortnight, 3 weeks, it was like a celebration parade rather than a a unit marching into war, if you follow me. People coming out and throwing flowers and offering you bottles of wine, and it's victory for them. It was great.
Did you see anything of collaborators?
A little town called Eftow, which is about 15 miles from Fay Camp, where they make the Benedictine. A place called Eftow. We were the first troops into Eftow, as we were in many other towns. And the first thing the FFI, the Free French Interior Forces, did, when they knew there were no more Germans about, they rounded up all the girls who'd been with the German soldiers. And on a public display, they shaved their heads. They roughly cut their hair off first of all, and then shaved their skull completely so that they were bald. And then they were forced to march through the rest of the village, who was stood up outside the town hall. Usually, that's where it usually happened. And they were spat upon and slapped and, you know, ridiculed. And if you ever saw a girl in those days with a headscarf on, she had a German boyfriend. That was a mark, you know, of shame for them.
How did you feel about it?
Sad. Great. It's sad. Because some of them were really beautiful girls, you know, I mean, and who could blame them? Who could really blame them? It's nature is nature. It was sad. But fortunately, we didn't have a lot of time to hang about to do anything about it, so we were always on the move. So, there you go.
What did you think of the quality of German opposition?
Generally speaking, very good. Good soldiers, the Germans. Very good. Some of it was some of their younger element. And I think only the Hitler Youth. They were fanatical to a point, but then they were little more than children, were they? When things began to get a bit hot, they wilted. But the German soldiers, the men, the mature soldier, I would say they're almost as good as ours. Very good soldiers indeed.
Were you actually involved in fighting yourself?
Not hand to hand or one to one, no. And it was not that kind of war. I was armed, as we all were, and if the occasion arose and I had to return fire, I returned fire, but you very seldom saw anybody face to face. You know, it's not a matter of, oh, poof. It was distance. And in France in particular, it was hedgerow distance. Everything was over hedgerows. You very seldom saw the enemy. All you heard were the incomings and your outgoings, you know, and machine gun fire raking the tops of the hedges and what have you. Very seldom saw them. I can only think the only time, well, that was at Walcheren. The only time I came actually face to face with them was on a Walcheren.
We'll come to that soon.
Yeah.
Can you take me on from August 44, please?
Well, from we were around the Fay Camp area on the coast of France, and from there we went to
Le Havre. Havre?
Le Havre. We went to Le Havre. There was possibly going to be some civil unrest in Le Havre from the French population, because they'd recently had very heavy air raids from the British in an attempt to get rid of the German garrison. And unfortunately, the only people that suffered were the civilian population, of which 4,000 or 5,000 of them were killed in this particular raid. And we went into Le Havre as a standby in case there was civil unrest, because the Germans had all pulled out. And it was very eerie, actually. You know, walking into a city, and instead of flowers and wine, what civilians you did see were giving you baleful looks, and not spitting, but, you know, they could have quite easily spat on you. They didn't care too much for us. And we didn't understand this at the time. And it's only later that we were told why they acted that way. And it's understandable, I suppose. But we weren't needed, and we were only there a short while. I can't remember how long, perhaps a couple of days. And then we were off again, and we went from there up to... Actually, it was Ostend. Anyway, we followed the coast up until we got... Sure, it was us. We went to Ostend. And then from Ostend, again, no contact with the Germans. From Ostend, we went to a place called De Haan in Holland for training. And this was prior to going to Walcheren. Market Garden, the airborne thing had taken place, and it hadn't come off. They hadn't achieved the object of the exercise. So we were earmarked to land on Walcheren, clear it, so that the port of Flushing and Antwerp could be used for supplies for the final push into Germany. So we did how long we've been in Den Haan, I should say about a month, 3 weeks or a month. And we were training, landing with weasels and motorised craft, you know, water carriers, buffaloes and weasels and that sort of thing. Which was quite pleasant, because we were billeted in hotels, which they'd taken over right on the seafront. You know, they'd taken over various hotels, and the unit was based or billeted in these hotels. So we were having a rest and recuperation and refitting and retraining, and reinforcements were coming through, ready for the landing on Walcheren. And October.
Don't worry about dates.
No, it's significant to me because we landed the day before my 22nd birthday on Walcheren. So we landed on November the 1st. So we left Ostend. We left Ostend on the night of the 31st of October by boat, landing craft. And we arrived off Walcheren at about 6 o'clock the following morning. Anyway, it was just getting light. And we were about 2 miles out, I suppose. And I remember seeing all these twinkling lights. Twinkle, 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 twinkle. And a friend of mine, Scotch guy, said to me, what's all those lights, Ed? What are those twinkling lights? So I said, well, if you wait a minute, Mac, you'll find out. And right enough, they were shells coming off the guns that the RAF had supposedly blown out of existence. And the whole island was ringed with guns in gun emplacements. And although the RAF had blown a hole in the wall of the island, for want of a better thing, and flooded the interior, and they'd also attacked the shore emplacements, they were either better dug in than we knew of, or the RAF had missed them, but there were a lot of them. And that's what these twinkling lights were. This was the Germans firing out. Anyway, as we got closer, we could see the lighthouse at West Capel, which is where we were going to land. And to our starboard, a rocket ship was hit. You know, these ships that fire, that got a direct hit, and that blew up. There were shells falling all round, but we weren't hit again. And we landed, I don't know, about half eight, I should imagine, a dry landing. And within 3 minutes, we were inside one of the gun emplacements where they were having breakfast, would you believe? They'd just got the coffee on. So, of course, we came flying in with hand a hock, you know, the usual and they did, hand a hock. And we had coffee. We had coffee, and 3 or 4 minutes after getting ashore, we were having coffee. And I honestly don't understand the mentality of the Germans. I mean, they'd been bombed and shelled. If they looked out to sea, they could see these landing craft, some of them a bit further up inland. They didn't believe it. They just did not believe that there'd been an invasion or a landing. They didn't believe it. They were having breakfast, they were doing this, they were going about their normal duties. And yet the guys in the gun emplacements knew, and they were firing at us. But the people a little bit further inland, not in the flooded area, but the headquarters and place, they just gave the impression that they didn't believe it. Anyway, West Capel, which was our objective, was secured on November the 1st. And then we had to go up the sand dunes towards Domburg, and there were a number of emplacements, concrete emplacements on the way up, which had to be taken, which they were, without a great deal of trouble. One or two people were killed on both sides. And eventually we got to Domburg, where the German headquarters was, and that was taken. I think we lost, in the 8 days we were there, I think we lost maybe 15, 20 people killed only. So, taking everything into consideration, it was fairly successful. The saddest part of it for me was a young officer who'd already won the DSO in Sicily, or Salerno, Italy. He and his batman, who'd also been decorated for the same action in Italy, they decided that they would attack this machine gun nest that was holding up the advance of our unit, and which they attempted to do, and they both got killed. And that was on the day it ended, the day they... So it was unnecessary, you know.
Did you see them get killed?
No, I didn't know. They were in a different troop to me.
Which troop were you in?
I was in P troop. They were in, I think he was in A troop. I think he was in A troop. It's either A or Y, I'm not sure. But it was so unnecessary. You know? I mean, blokes who get killed in landings and subsequent actions, which you've got no control over, sad as it is, it's acceptable, isn't it? But for on the last day, you know, when half an hour would have made all that much difference, that bloke could still be alive. Anyway, when the island was finally secured, which would be about the 8th or the 9th of November, we went to a place called Bergen op Zoom, which is in Holland, for a couple of days R&R. Replacements were brought out and training again as usual. And then we moved up to a little village on the Mars, which was called Waspik. It's only a little village. And as we came into this village, there were no men. They were all women. And every woman who could possibly conceive was pregnant. Every woman in the village was pregnant who could possibly be pregnant, and they'd all been raped by the SS, who had pulled out some time ago, obviously. But they were all around about 4 or 5 months pregnant, and all the men had been shot.
How did you discover all this?
Well, I'm coming to it now. As we came into this village, and incidentally, most or a lot of the Dutch people have a great understanding of the English language. A lot of them speak fluent English. And in this village, a young boy, be about 9 or 10, I suppose, came out and asked one of our chaps what unit they were, you know. Well, we were known as the 4th SS Brigade, but the SS stood for Special Services, not the way the Germans were, whatever their SS stood for, I don't know. But this kid heard the words SS and went running off to his mother. And eventually, when they realised that they weren't going to be raped and pillaged and what have you, they appeared, and we got the story from them that what had happened to them and why they were all pregnant, and all their men had been taken away and shot. So we were on